A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Fountain Street Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on November 25, 2001, entitled 911 to an Unknown God. The text for the sermon is Acts 17, verse 16. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
We find the Apostle Paul coming into the city of Athens, and on one of those missionary journeys, he has a bit of time in between meeting companions and being on his way again, and he surveys the city of Athens with all of its diverse idols and temples and statues, and we find him there in the 16th verse of the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So they took him and brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now all of the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, he who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live by shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. For from one ancestor, he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said. For we are God's offspring." Thus far. Let us be in the spirit of prayer. Eternal God, creator of all that is, enlivening spirit whose breath gives life. In the beginning, O God, your spirit wind brooded over the soupy chaos of emerging cosmos, bringing forth order, beauty, and rhythmic regularity and a rich diversity of infinite possibility. It is with awe that we contemplate heaven set with a myriad of starry diamonds in the inky blackness. It is with delight that we trace the breaking dawn bask in the radiant warmth of the sun at zenith, watch with wonder its final moments, firing all with golden glow before it slips beneath the far horizon. Summer and winter, springtime and harvest, all beautiful the march of days as seasons come and go, The hand that shaped the rose has wrought the crystal of the snow. Wonder, mystery, all about us if we have eyes to see, ears to hear. If for a moment we pause, fully conscious, fully aware, attentive to the reality into which our lives are woven, a tapestry we can never fully take in. Yet now and then, O God, we get a glimpse of the grandeur of it all and know ourselves to be a living part of it all, bringing to the emerging wonder a consciousness, self-consciousness, consciousness of the other, the dawning of communion, the foundation of community. Ah, dear God, the mystery deepens before the consciousness of ourselves, of the other. We find ourselves in the presence of the mystery, indeed, in your presence, O God, mystery of being, mystery of our being together. We cannot fully take it in. We cannot fully fathom the cosmic depths or the depths of our own being. Yet in moments of awareness, we realize that we have been gifted with life, gifted with insight into the larger reality in which we share, gifted with a sense of being known and of knowing, knowing who we are and knowing the other. In the stillness of this magnificent space, we contemplate the wonder of it all. It is a pleasure to be here. I think it was about 2 years ago that I was here in this pulpit, and it was a fine morning then, and coming back today, it's like coming home. It's nice to come to a place and feel at home. And certainly Fountain Street Church has become for me a place of warmth, of affirmation, encouragement, and inspiration. It took me a long time to get there, but then I'm a late bloomer. And finally, it's good to be here and to be at home. We hear a lot these days about September 11, 9/11 being a defining moment for this generation. There are those significant moments in the course of human affairs which have a shaping effect upon the present and the future. And certainly the attack upon our nation on September 11 was one such moment. I'm not sure whether the intention was to have the attack on 9/11, which is also the number we dial for an emergency, or whether that happened to be simply a coincidence. But in any case, 9/11 has been burned into our consciousness, never to fade. It's one of those times when we are taken back, and we're given pause, and an opportunity to step back and to think once again about those things that are ultimately important. And of course, at a time like that, we flee to old securities. to the old securities of patriotism, for example. I've seen more American flags flying in these recent weeks than ever in my life, I swear. And it's understandable, too, for the flag is a symbol of those freedoms, the values by which we live and with which we are blessed. The flag is a sign of our affection for this nation and our recognition of how fortunate we are to be a part of the American scene. Someone has said to be a born American is already to have won the lotto. And so we fly our flags as a sign of our appreciation and our affection for this nation. But the flying of the flags, the patriotism, also has another dimension to it. It is a sign of that nationalism which is really a less than wholesome response. And nationalism is really, on a grand scale, simply the tribalism with which we've evolved. So that the flying of the flag and the retreat to patriotism can be a bit belligerent, as we say, we're the US of A and don't mess with us. That probably is the downside of that flight to patriotism, and yet, once again, we understand it. So we flee to patriotism, but we also flee to piety, don't we? Goodness me, I thought I was going to have a terrific sermon on September 16th by the looks of the crowd. Everybody went to church, temples, mosques. There was a flight to piety because we were seeking once again in our insecurity and vulnerability that word of assurance that there was someone in control. Fortunately, that level of attention cannot be maintained, that level of emotional response. A week or two and the churches were back to half full. Thank God for that. But what we have done with all those people, all those less than serious observers of religion. But nonetheless, it was a sign of that instinctual response within the human being under threat in a time of peril, a retreat to old securities, a wish, a hope that somebody's in control, a fleeing to the refuge of an almighty God, an omnipotent God, the Lord and Sovereign of history. Dear God, how we wanted it to be so. In the midst of the recognition and the awareness, not of a changed world, but a world simply becoming conscious that we are vulnerable and exposed, and the old securities simply don't work. We still hoped perhaps there might be someone in charge. Ah, yes, Almighty God. And that's understandable too, because it's not religion after all. That search at quest of the human spirit in the midst of the insecurity of life, living before the face of mystery, that search for meaning, that search for understanding, that search for security, is that not how it all began? As far back as we can trace the human story, there is the religious dimension. And the religious dimension is simply that human being, that animal become human, dawning in consciousness, becoming aware. And becoming aware, becoming conscious, becoming self-conscious, aware of so much that is out of control, so much that is full of mystery and threat, and all of that causing that search and quest for what it all means. And where one might find some safety some solace, some peace. As far as we trace back, that's the story, the religious story of the human being. Religions are human imaginative constructs. The great religions of the world are the consequence of someone's vision. Someone's vision that found resonance in the minds and hearts of a community who developed a creed, a dogma, a doctrine, developed modes of worship, devotion, ritual, hymns and prayers, and a way of life, a moral code. That's really what we're about in the religious quest, isn't it? A vision, an idea, a story, an explanation or an understanding, some confessional statement, and then some expectation about the way one is to live, some moral code. Religion is a human imaginative creative construct in the face of the mystery before which we live every day of our lives. And so can we not understand that on a day like September 11, when suddenly the mask of our security is ripped off, that we would retreat to piety, to the search for security, to the longing for that one to be in control. But there's no one in control, dear friends. To announce that in Fountain Street's pulpit is no radical declaration. And yet I think in the wake of September 11, once again, it's important for us to recognize the temptation to flee to an anachronistic creed. Understanding, though we might, how natural and instinctual it is to seek for security, the thing that has to be announced and proclaimed and declared and taken in is the fact that history is in our hands. There's no one in control. And it's time for us to make a new declaration, because this is an emergency. For what we see in the world at present is the consequence of what religion gone awry can do. It has been very good that we have been delicate about this matter, from our top leaders on down, to recognize that what we have to do is not with Islam as a religion, but we have to do with religion in its fundamentalist aspects that can drive human beings to acts of travesty and devastation. And that old religion that has such power, that can fuel human passions, is a religion that has to be declared out of bounds in a world like ours that has no room for that kind of fanaticism, that frenzy of responding to an almighty God. The supernatural God is dead, has been dead for a long time. It just takes the church a long time to catch up with that realization. When Paul came to Athens in the first century, he came distressed in spirit. I have been to Athens too, and I wasn't distressed, I was awed. It makes me wonder a bit about the apostle. How could he go to Athens, that university city of the world, that magnificent city that is still wonderful in its ruins? How could he have come and been distressed? But of course, he came there, this Jewish man whose God was Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had been knocked off his horse by a vision, a mystical experience, believing with all of his heart and all of his passion that the eternal God, the one true God, the creator of heaven and earth, the sovereign Lord of history, had revealed himself in the embodiment of Jesus Christ, the Christ who appeared to Paul and had sent him on a mission. And therefore, as he came to Athens and he saw the diversity of temples and statues and the signs of all of that pagan religion that was a part of the great Eastern mysteries, he was distressed in his spirit. And being a bold and courageous man, full of passion, he confronted those wherever he went, on the street, in the marketplace, until finally they invited him to come and to have his say on the Areopagus at Mars Hill. I took a little group of pilgrims there a few years ago and made them find a spot of shade in Mars Hill, and then I preached to them so I could get the feel of what Paul must have felt. But there he was, passionate man that he was, man of vision that he was, man of power that he was. He came to them, and a good preacher that he was, he connected with his audience very well. He said to them, I see that you are very religious. And he complimented them for their religious concern. And he saw that they had temples and statues and all sorts of gods and goddesses in their pantheon. But he noticed also here and there statues to an unknown god. What he perhaps had not known is that 600 years prior to that, there had been a plague in the city. And a poet from Crete named Epimenides had devised a plan whereby they let loose a flock of sheep from the agora, let them wander at will until they lay down. And wherever they lay down, that sheep was offered as a sacrifice to the nearest god. And if a sheep lay down next to a shrine without a god, then there was a statue erected to the unknown god, because the Athenians were careful to cover every quarter. And when Paul saw that, and out of his fresh experience of encounter with Jesus Christ, and out of his background as a Jew who believed in the core of Israel's creed that God is one, Paul could not help himself. And so he addressed them. He addressed them in terms of this one true God, this creator of heaven and earth, this one who set the boundaries and the times and seasons of all humankind, and who was bringing all things to consummation. For Paul believed that he was living on the edge of history. He believed that he had been called to proclaim this good news throughout that ancient world before the end come. To an unknown God, with all the boldness and the arrogance and the passion of faith, he said, that unknown God I proclaim to you. Don't you suspect that 2,000 years later, it's time to try again? Don't we know that God of Paul, the imagery of God in Paul's terms, which are the biblical terms, which are the Christian terms, the Jewish terms, the Muslim terms, don't we know that whole religious landscape posits a God that doesn't exist? That almighty God, that omnipotent one, that one in control, don't we know enough of our world and of our human experience by now to know that it's incredible? Let me cite you a couple of statements from some of the disciplines of human learning. Jacques Monod, for example, in his Nobel-winning Chance and Necessity, he says, if he accepts this negative message in its full significance, man must at last wake out of his millenary dreams and discover his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. He must realize that like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his sufferings and his crimes. Erich Fromm in Man for Himself There's only one solution to his problem: to face the truth, to acknowledge his fundamental aloneness in the universe, indifferent to his fate, to recognize that there is no power transcending him that can solve his problem for him. And finally, this from G.N. Clark in his inaugural address at Cambridge University: there is no secret and no plan in history to be discovered. I do not believe that any future consummation could make sense of all the irrationalities of preceding ages. It could not explain them, still less could it justify them. Well, just three voices, contemporary voices, relatively contemporary voices. In the wake of what we've learned about our human experience, about nature, through the sciences, all of the disciplines of human learning, coming to recognize that God of Paul, that God of the Bible, that supernatural being in a realm beyond, calling us to an age beyond all of that mythology, comes to ruin on the rocks of the reality of our present knowledge of our world and our human experience. And it's time that we come to terms with that. You know, there are all kinds of good churches around, and they're doing all kinds of good things. There are fundamentalist churches of every stripe and Pentecostal churches of every stripe, and there are Orthodox conservative churches. There are sacramental churches. There are liberal churches. And you can go the whole spectrum, from the horror of the Taliban to the most liberal of pleasant communities. But all of them are on the spectrum, and all of them are still positing some kind of supernatural scheme with some kind of supernatural being who shifts the gears of the universe and pulls strings and will finally make everything right. You don't have to be a screaming fundamentalist. You don't have to be mean, down and dirty. You can be suave and smooth and liberal and open. But until you cross the Rubicon of acknowledging that there's no God out there, you're all playing in the same ballgame. And it's a dangerous ballgame, because religion is powerful, and it provides the fuel for the frantic action of frenzied people. It can be co-opted by unscrupulous leaders. And in the name of God, all kinds of atrocities have been perpetrated down through the centuries. Jewish, Christian, Islamic, fundamentalisms of any stripe, in the name of God, wreak havoc on the human scene. There's no one out there. It's ironic that I should say that here, for it was in the mid-70s that I heard Duncan Littlefair say it here. I think the last time I was here, I mentioned that incident because it was stamped on my consciousness, never to be lost. Honk If You Love Jesus was the title. And the text from Matthew, the 11th chapter: come unto me, all ye labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Duncan said, there's no one out there. And I was troubled by that, because my whole ministry, my whole life was posited on the conviction that there was someone out there. And the choir abated my distress only a little bit when they sang, "The Lord bless you and keep you." And so it is ironic that I come back here some 20 years later to say that Duncan was right. And this congregation, has had that kind of a ministry and that kind of a voice for over 100 years. Do you know that? Sometimes you can become a part of a great place like this without fully understanding its roots, knowing that it has stood alone on the other side of the Rubicon. No one out there. So then are we left bereft? Is there no hope? Is there no comfort? Is there no religious solace? Oh, not at all. For if I could point to my own experience, I would say to you that there is more wonder and awe in my life today as I contemplate not the God out there, but that mystery of being within, that pervasive presence of creative spirit that has pervaded the cosmic process of billions of years and have brought us to this present moment. I don't need a God out there pulling strings and shifting gears and intervening episodically into the course of events, of human affairs, for I can contemplate the wonder and the real miracle. And that is out of the cosmic, out of the soup of the cosmos, out of star stuff and stardust. We've come to a community like this in a moment like this, when with awareness we can be conscious of that which is sacred and that which is holy, conscious of the fact that this whole process of billions of years has emerged in the human and is not, after all, the incarnation which we'll celebrate so shortly now, really the story of how God has become human, or the human is the locus of the divine. Has not this process emerged in the likes of us who can stand in wonder, who can give voice to the universe? Are we not that self-consciousness of the whole process that can contemplate itself and offer adoration and praise? Is not the miracle that we are here together in community, that we can confront one another, that we can look into one another's eyes, that we who have come out of that initial cosmic explosion are here aware of ourselves, aware of one another in community, recognizing that although there is no one out there, it is in our hands, and it is for us to secure this world, that it has been put into our hands to live with compassion, to live with passion, and to make sure that the future is secured for coming generations. It is in our hands to bring peace to the world. There are those magnificent prophetic pictures of messianic eras in the prophets, when the lion and the lamb will lie down together and no one will hurt or destroy in all God's holy mountain. And I see those now as magnificent pictures, poetic dreams, dreams not of some future state, but a critique of every human arrangement until finally we come to our senses and grow up to a maturity enough to take responsibility for our lives and our world and our history. Oh, it is not at all a barren, bereft condition with which we are left, but it is an amazing experience of grace every day. Marveling at every sunrise and every sunset, at the flow of the seasons, at the lilt of a child's laughter. This, my friends, is the human story. This is our opportunity. This is our privilege. This is our calling. God, not almighty, omnipotent, out there controlling, but God inwardly moving, not with power, but with love, the persuasion of love, the vulnerability of love. The irony, you know, is that the Christian God who is revealed in Jesus This is a God who was revealed in the flesh of a child at Christmas and crucified on Good Friday. Because you see, where the Spirit manifests itself, the Spirit is powerless, the Spirit is vulnerable. And I can give you no guarantee that we'll finally pull this out or pull this off. For we are powerless except the power of love. The power of love that cannot force itself. But neither will it ever be defeated. For finally, that God within is biased toward life and love and grace and freedom. Oh, I'd like to suggest to you, Fountain Streeters, that you go out with the passion and the conviction of St. Paul and change Grand Rapids. Turn it from its erring orthodox ways. Turn it from its conservatism, its meanness of spirit, its arrogance, its self-righteousness. Tell them of the unknown God. But you see, it doesn't work that way. All you can do is be what you are. And be an island and an oasis, eschewing the supernatural being of traditional religion and embodying that God, that spirit, that creative movement from within, and be open to all who come searching. Some of us on a long, long journey. But thank God for a place like this. You are unique, you know, for not many have had the courage to cross the Rubicon. Not many have had the courage to say, nobody out there. So let's get busy with this, our human situation, by God.